All right, this morning I'm going to talk about purity, sexual purity, in the book of Proverbs. And I want to start, who remembers the Space Shuttle Challenger? Okay, all the older people, basically, in the room. Anybody see it live? I saw it live. I was homesick from school and saw it live on TV. But if you're not familiar, a little over 40 years ago, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded about 73 seconds after takeoff. It killed all seven crew members. And if you watched it, or if you see a clip of it, the catastrophe looks instantaneous. It's going up and then, you know, it explodes. But the disaster had actually been developing long before the explosion ever happened. Engineers knew that the shuttle's O-rings that would keep hot combustible gas from escaping had problems, especially had problems at colder temperatures. And they had seen these warning signs. They had let management know this is going to be a problem if we launch and it's cold. And yet, in decision after decision, management pressed ahead with the launch. And so the explosion in the sky that everybody saw, the disaster, was really just the final manifestation of a series of problems that happened and had begun much earlier on the ground. And I think something similar happens with sexual sin. We tend to think of the point of failure being the outward act, the actual thing that gets committed. But Proverbs teaches us to look further upstream than the actual result. And the final act is usually the culmination of a series of choices and thoughts and movements that began much earlier than that. So here's my thesis for today. Sexual sin rarely begins with the decision to sin. It begins with a series of decisions that make sin easier to choose. Very rarely do we decide to act out in sin, but we often will make a series of decisions that make sin easier to choose. Maybe you've been in an accountability relationship with somebody, and maybe you've heard somebody say, or maybe you've said yourself, I blew it. I blew it, right? And it's kind of like everything was fine, and then all of a sudden, just I just blew it. I messed up. And the question that we really need to ask is, where did you blow it exactly? It's not just that you had a fall. The fall began somewhere. It didn't just happen. You weren't fine one moment and then all of a sudden sin. So where did you blow it? Where in the sequence? And so when it comes to thinking about where sexual temptation begins, Proverbs gives us two places to look: the heart and the path. And the heart we'll focus on in Proverbs 4 and the path in Proverbs 7. So if you have a Bible with you, turn to Proverbs 4, beginning at verse 23. I'm going to focus first on 23 and then proceed after that. So Proverbs 4:23, probably familiar to many of us. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. I prefer a different translation, the NET, which says, guard your heart with all I want to say vigilance, and I think that's from a Shakespeare play. I think that's Dogberry says vigilance. Guard your heart with all vigilance, for from it are the sources of life. I like guard more than keep. If you think about Adam was put in the garden to work and keep it. Part of his job was to guard the garden. And obviously he did a poor job in guarding the garden. But we're called to do the same for our hearts. We're called to guard our hearts. And the biblical heart is more than just emotions. The heart is the center of our thoughts, our desires, our intentions, our imagination, and our will. It's kind of the executive center for life. And so sexual purity begins on the inside. You can have filters, you can have website blockers, you can have accountability partners, you can have all those things. But if we allow our inner life to go unchecked, all those things won't matter. They won't matter in the end. The first territory that we have to guard and be vigilant about is our own heart. And so I want to talk for a few minutes about thoughts, because thoughts are kind of the entree into our heart. Thoughts can arrive in our consciousness without permission. You may have just a bizarre, wild thought, and you'll be like, where in the world did that come from? You didn't consciously conjure up that thought. It just came. And it could be an image, it could be a memory, it could be an attraction, it could be any of those things, and they just kind of pop into your head. We're not responsible for every thought that pops into our head, but we are responsible for what we then do with those thoughts, for where we let those thoughts go. We're responsible for that. If we don't continue to think about a thought, it will go away. Like, it will just disappear. Something else will take its place if we don't think about it. It might return again, but if we continue to not think about it, then it will drop off. Thoughts only take us somewhere when we give them sustained attention. When we begin to think about that thought and nurture it and give it attention and allow it to grow in our mind, then it can take us somewhere. And so, think about the sequence in this way. A thought given sustained attention becomes a desire. You begin to want to pursue that road. You begin to think about it more. And then it develops into a passion. That's when the body begins to get involved. And there are physiological processes that join the thoughts in its sustained attention. And then ultimately, there's a choice, a decision. Do I act on this? Do I not act on this? Do I continue going down this road or do I not? And this could happen in like 5 seconds. You know, this makes it sound like a very long, drawn-out process. It's not. Especially if the path is well grooved and it's an area of temptation that you experience a lot. I mean, it can happen quite quickly. So thought given sustained attention becomes desire, becomes passion, and then leads you to a choice. So a couple of key principles. Again, you don't have to control every thought that comes into your mind, but you do have to decide which thoughts get to stay, which thoughts you're going to give oxygen and feed and allow to be there. That's what you have to choose. That's what I have to choose. And the sooner that we notice a thought, a bad thought, and distance ourselves from it, the easier it is to respond rightly. The battle is easiest to win right here. This is the place where it's easiest to win the battle, to be able to distance ourselves from the thoughts that come into our mind, to be able to dismiss them, to be able to not give them attention. Once we give them attention, and then once they become desires, and then once the body gets involved, it becomes a lot harder to make the right choice when a choice comes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Would everybody agree it's a lot easier to fight the battle at the level of the thought rather than at the level of a passion or when you actually are going to make the choice? That's why we can't wait until we're on the verge of sin to begin fighting temptation. I'm not saying it's too late. You can still get out of it then, but it is a whole lot harder because all the momentum is going in the wrong direction for you. Proverbs 4:23 tells us to guard the heart, and then in the verses that follow, it tells us what guarding our heart actually looks like. So let's continue on in Proverbs 4. Put away from you crooked speech, and put devious talk far from you. Let your eyes look directly forward, and your gaze be straight before you. Ponder the path of your feet. Then all your ways will be sure. Do not swerve to the right or to the left. Turn your foot away from evil. So guarding our heart involves what we say, where we direct our eyes, where our gaze goes, and where our feet go. So we have control over those things. We have control over where our eyes go, and we have control over where our feet go. And that's how we guard our heart. Proverbs 7, then, shows us what happens when a man doesn't guard his heart. And he doesn't watch where his eyes go, and he doesn't watch what he says, and he doesn't watch where his feet go. And so his feet take him where he does not belong. So go ahead and turn to Proverbs 7. I'm going to read the whole chapter because it's a story that gets played out. My son, keep my words and treasure up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teaching as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call insight your intimate friend to keep you from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words. For at the window of my house, I have looked out through my lattice, and I have seen among the simple. I have perceived among the youths a young man lacking sense, passing along the street near her corner, taking the road to her house in the twilight, in the evening, at the time of night and darkness. And behold, the woman meets him, dressed as a prostitute, wily of heart. She is loud and wayward. Her feet do not stay at home. Now in the street, now in the market, and at every corner she lies in wait. She seizes him and kisses him. And with bold face she says to him, I had to offer sacrifices, and today I have paid my vows. So now I have come out to meet you, to seek you eagerly, and I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings, colored linens from Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love till morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He took a bag of money with him. At full moon he will come home. With much seductive speech, she persuades him. With her smooth talk, she compels him. All at once, he follows her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast, till an arrow pierces its liver, as a bird rushes into the snare. He does not know that it will cost him his life. And now, O sons, listen to me, and be attentive to the words of my mouth. Let not your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. For many a victim she has laid low, and all her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is a way to Sheol, going down to the chambers of death. So here's the plot summary. A man commits adultery with another man's wife. But what we want to recognize is that the man doesn't originally set out with that as his goal. If you were going to ask him at the beginning of the night, what are your plans tonight? He would not have said, I'm going to go commit adultery with another man's wife. But he ends up there. And we want to look at how he ends up there. So first of all, he's among the simple. He lacks sense. His inner life is already arranged toward what is easy, toward what is comfortable, toward what is pleasurable, toward what he wants. He's near her corner, near the road to her house. He's already chosen to put himself in proximity to where something illicit could happen. He's already put himself there. It's at twilight, in the evening, at night, in darkness. Four different ways of saying it is the time of the day when he should not be out where he is. He's less likely to be observed there in the twilight, in the evening, at night, in the darkness. There's an emphasis on his hiddenness. So he's already moving in the wrong direction before he ever ends up talking with her and being in a position to do anything with her. He's already made a series of decisions that are going to put him in the wrong place. The adulteress doesn't have to drag him into the house. He has already said, temptation, here I am. Come get me. The fool's problem isn't that he encounters temptation. We all encounter temptation. That's not his problem. It's that he puts himself where temptation is waiting for him and can capture him. That is on him, to put himself in that position. And for us, there are places, there are situations, there are websites, conversations, relationships, habits, and times of day when we're more vulnerable. When we're more vulnerable to those kind of things. And wisdom recognizes vulnerability long before the situation. We have to know ourselves. We have to know, when am I vulnerable? You know, am I more vulnerable to sexual temptation when I'm depressed, when things aren't going well in life, when I'm discouraged? Am I more vulnerable to that? Or is it after success? You know, experience the high of success, things are going well, and then that's when I'm actually vulnerable. We have to know ourselves. We can't continually put ourselves in situations where we have to demonstrate extraordinary self-control. We don't want to put ourselves in positions where we have to demonstrate extraordinary self-control. We want to stay away from situations where we know we're going to be vulnerable. So he's already made poor decisions that have put him there, and then the adulteress supplies the man with reasons to continue taking this course. She says, "Everything is fine. I've taken care of the religious obligations. The circumstances are safe. My husband isn't home. We don't have to worry about him. No one will know. No one will know what happens." She frames it as something other than it really is. She says, "Let us take our fill of love." She calls it love. She doesn't call it adultery, because that would be poor advertising for what it is that she wants. She calls it love. She calls it something other than it really is. Temptation doesn't just offer pleasure. Temptation offers explanations and rationalizations and justifications. All the reasons why it's just fine to keep moving down this path and ultimately to choose what it is that temptation wants you to choose. It offers all the reasons why it's fine. And so instead of starving the temptation, the guy is keeping it alive by listening to all her reasons. And we do that too. You know, maybe thoughts like, "Well, I wonder what other movies she's in." Or, "I wonder what that term means." Or, "Is it really so bad to see that?" And you keep going down the path and going down the path. Thoughts, attention, desire, passion, comes choice. And then we get to the moment of choice for this guy in verse 22. He says, all at once he follows her. But, I mean, really, if you look at the whole thing, it's not all at once that he decides to follow her. The final decision looks sudden, but it really isn't that sudden. There's been a sequence of decisions: being there, staying there, looking, listening, entertaining, rationalizing, moving closer, and then finally following him. By the time he goes, he's all but carried forward by all the momentum that's been there of his own dumb choices. Does that make sense? So here's the major takeaway, and I said this before. Sexual sin rarely begins with the decision to sin. It begins with a series of decisions that make it easier to sin when the moment of choice comes. And we see that with this guy in his series of decisions that make sin easier to choose. And there's a tragic end. He does not know that it will cost him his life. I think if you told this guy before the beginning of the night, before he went out, "Hey man, if you leave your house tonight, you're going to die." If he trusts you at all, he's probably going to stay home. I think if one of you told me, "Hey, by the way, I happen to know if you leave your house tonight, you're going to die," I'd probably stay home. But he doesn't. And he can't, that's not in his calculus for how the night is going to turn out with his own death. But he does not know that it will cost him his life. So what do we do? Well, we notice it early, okay? Recognize the thought. Recognize the rationalizations that come into our minds of why it's okay to keep that thought alive and to keep pursuing it. Don't pretend that you don't know what's happening. And then interrupt it. Don't investigate the curiosity. You know, sometimes guys after they blow it will say, "I got curious." Well, you have to recognize when you're getting curious, and you have to kill the curiosity, because that's a bad kind of curiosity. So don't investigate the curiosity. Turn your attention elsewhere and do whatever you have to short circuit the temptation, to interrupt it, to not give it oxygen. The goal is not merely to resist the final act. The goal is to interrupt the process that allows it to develop. And if you have to, if you get to the point, though, where you're here, the best thing you can do is run. Run from it. Flee from it. And here, Joseph, I think, is the biblical model for this. This is from Genesis 39. You know the story, but I do think it's worth looking at. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or be with her. So, I think this is instructive for us. Potiphar's wife puts it out there in the beginning, "Lie with me." And Joseph refuses. But she wasn't done trying. She keeps at it, but she changes tactics. It says in verse 10, she spoke to Joseph day after day. I think she lessened her demands. Okay, lie with me didn't work. Well, I'm going to try something else. Just lie beside me and we'll talk. And Joseph says, "No, I'm not going to do that because I know where that's going to go. Just be with me. Just talk with me. Spend time with me. And you know, we can talk about other things. And we can joke about Potiphar and things that Potiphar does." And Joseph knows, well, I think Potiphar's wife knows that if she can win one battle, then she'll probably win the next battle. If she can get Joseph to spend some time talking with her, then maybe she can get him to lie beside her. And if she can get him to lie beside her, then maybe things will develop after that. And Joseph knows that too. And so Joseph doesn't consent to anything that will make the next battle that much more difficult. And on that fateful day when no one was around, she seized him. And Joseph didn't stand around testing his self-control. He ran. I mean, he ran and he left his coat behind. And sometimes the most spiritual thing that you can do is to run. It's to run. Put the phone down, get out of bed, go in another room, do manual labor, dig a ditch, put on your running shoes, run. Do whatever you have to, but get out of the immediate situation that you are in. So, to conclude and summarize, what supports our sexual purity? Guard your heart, which means guarding our thoughts and being aware of where they want to go. Watch your path. Be aware of where it is that your feet are taking you, particularly your digital feet. And if you're on the wrong path, then run and get out of there as fast as you can. We pursue purity because our bodies, our minds, our desires all belong to Jesus the King. They don't belong to us. They belong to Him. And so purity isn't merely saying no to something. It's learning to love what is good more than we love the momentary pleasure of sin. Amen.